The need for residential group homes for people with disabilities is rising, but Illinois has been seeing a shortage of professional caregivers for these homes.
The crux of the battle is Illinois says that they are adequately funding group homes. The group home industry is saying, no, you're not.
Chicago Tribune reporter Michael Behrens joins us, along with a Champaign father whose adult daughter with autism has been waiting more than 3 years to move into a group home. Plus, many women who are pregnant receive unwelcome comments about their bodies. Red Eye Chicago editor Lauren Cheval tells us why she can't wait until people stop seeing her body as public property. And there might be a state budget, but some school superintendents are warning of dire consequences if lawmakers don't take action on school funding.
Schools are going to be in a less capable position to meet the standards placed on us by the state if nothing passes.
We'll learn what's at stake in our weekly politics update. That's coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield, filling in for Nyla Boodoo today. In the last decade, Illinois has shifted from large living institutional facilities for people with disabilities to small residential homes, hoping that people will lead fuller lives embedded within the community. Currently, more than 11,000 people live in group homes statewide, according to the Chicago Tribune. But as the number of people in group homes has increased, Illinois has been experiencing a shortage of professional caregivers, which may be due to low pay, as the wage rate for workers has not changed in 9 years. A recent Chicago Tribune investigation found 200 cases of abuse and neglect in group homes, with a majority of the cases linked to inadequate staffing levels and failure to closely monitor the residents. We'll speak with a Tribune reporter here in just a few moments, but first I'm joined in studio now by David Happ, resident of Philo, just southeast of Urbana. David's daughter Brittany has autism and has faced challenges when it comes to finding a group home. So David, I want to welcome you to the 21st and thanks for being here and sharing your story.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
So your daughter, Brittany, is 25, and she's wanted to live independently now for 3 years, but hasn't been able to. So can you give us an idea of what's been holding her back?
Yeah, a little bit of background first. She moved from Illinois to an out-of-state facility for a while and finished up her schooling. And at that time, she was living in essentially a group home. When she did that, she really blossomed. She really learned a lot of skills. And we knew that we wanted to find something like that when she came back to live with us in Illinois. So for the past 3 or 4 years, we've been looking for that type of place. About 2.5 or 3 years ago, we found one. A local provider is opening up a new house in Mahomet, just west of Champaign. Brittany was chosen to live there. They got the house purchased, furnished, 4 people ready to move in. But unfortunately, they just haven't had the staff to support the people that want to live there.
Wow. Okay. So before we get into the staffing situation, you alluded to the fact that Brittany does better in these group home situations. So would you say that's the sole and most important reason for getting her into this home, or are there other factors with that?
Well, that's the main reason. We know we're trying to be realistic. At some point, my wife and I won't be able to take care of her. So eventually, she's going to have to live in a group home. We don't want to be one of those families that waits until it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we started doing the legwork immediately and try to line something up. It's going to have to happen, so why not do it now? And also, because she did so well in a group home, we would rather have her not transition to back into our family home because mm-hmm. she lost some of those skills. We can't do anything about it now, so she's back in our house, and hopefully she won't lose those skills and can transition back into a group home where she's going to do much better.
Yeah, and I'm sure she wants to live, you know, a more independent lifestyle as well, being 25 and wanting to grow and prosper in her own ways. So you talked about the legwork. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of the process behind finding this home in Mahomet, what that was like for you and your wife?
Well, every situation is different. Ours, because she had been in an out-of-state facility, she was given priority when she moved back to Illinois because everyone familiar with her knew that that was what was best for her. And so we looked at other facilities in the state, couldn't find one that we really liked. We wanted a smaller home with maybe 4 residents. We wanted a small-town setting. And so we held out for something that we felt comfortable with. And that's why when this one in Mahomet came up, it was just perfect. It was everything we wanted. It was 3 of her peers that are the same age, the same near skill level. It's a nice setting. It's a beautiful house. And so at that point, we stopped looking and said, this is the one we want.
So how has the past 3 years, I know you also alluded to the fact that, you know, Brittany really flourished when she was out of state and perhaps maybe taking a few steps back now that she's back in your home. But how has this affected Brittany and your family?
Well, I mean, I hate to sound like I'm complaining or giving selfish reasons, but it's definitely affected our family. My wife and I were not, one of us pretty much has to be with Brittany all the time, unless she's at work, which is nice. During the day, she's at work from 9 to 2:30. But short of that, other than a couple of hours here and there, one of us is with her all the time, which means we don't go on vacations together. We don't go out to eat together. We don't go to church together. All these things we have to give up because one of us is with her all the time. We do have a very clean house and a very organized pantry and kitchen because those are the things that she obsesses over. But like I said, I hate to complain. There's people that are in a lot worse situations than we are.
Well, and I don't think it's necessarily complaining. It's wanting what's the best for your daughter, of course. Before we bring someone else into the conversation, I was just curious. You mentioned that Brittany is working. Mm-hmm. So even though she's not placed in the home, she is able to work. And that would continue once she gets in the home, correct?
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons we also chose this house, because it would be run by the same agency that she works at. A developmental services center here in Champaign is where she works, and they'll be the ones running and operating the house.
Okay. And speaking of that center, I want to bring Sarah Curtis into the conversation. She is from Champaign and worked for the same agency that is trying to find workers to staff Brittany's home in Mahomet. From 2004 to 2010, Sarah worked for the Developmental Services Agency as a manager of a day program. Sarah, welcome to the 21st and welcome to the conversation.
Hello.
So why do you think it is hard to find workers for house programs and group homes, Sarah?
I mean, definitely the wage issue is huge. As much as you might love the work and feel like it's really what satisfies you and your kind of professional identity, it can be very difficult when you are providing for your family and you have to take a second job to be able to do that. So then you're constantly feeling burnt out, or if you're constantly understaffed, then for the folks who are still working, their stress level and that constant influx, you know, that nothing's the same day to day can be really difficult to maintain. So I think, you know, that's kind of the primary problem. You know, there's other jobs where you're in the same wage bracket, and maybe they aren't as personally satisfying, but they might not be as challenging either in terms of being able to do kind of the same thing consistently.
So last year, Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed a bill aimed to increase minimum wage for workers. They currently make $9.35 an hour on average, and lawmakers are currently considering a legislation that would raise that amount to $15 an hour. So what I'm hearing from you is that the wage increase would be a huge boost, because I assume that a lot of people that you work with or caregivers have to have second jobs, and maybe that affects their ability to do their job at the home.
Yes, and I just want to clarify. I worked in the day program environment, so providing work opportunities and then other therapeutic and recreational opportunities for folks during the day. So direct service providers work in both group homes and day programs. So there's, you know, it is a diversified workforce in those ways. Some direct service providers are working with people in their own apartments and doing, you know, coming in and then helping them doing some job coaching and community work settings. So it is, you know, there are quite a few different kinds of work that are considered direct service providers. But I think across the board, wages are an issue, definitely.
Okay. Well, one agency in DuPage County said that their turnover rate has grown from 40% in 2016 to 56% just the beginning of this year of 2017. So, Sarah, did you find that you experienced similar turnover rate here locally? And if so, could you speak to what that is? Is it beyond the wages or just the wages?
I think that most agencies would kind of have a similar story, where they have a strong core of dedicated professionals who have been in the field for years and years and years, and this is really their passion and their career. And then I think where you really start to have difficulty is in bringing in that next generation of employees who see it as their calling. So to kind of get people to, you know, so that that older generation of direct service providers had come in on wages that were more representative of a living wage. And now, and they kind of got hooked. But now, as wages have stagnated, their folks are not coming in on a living wage. And so it's difficult to really kind of keep them longer over time.
So what is the training process that these people are going through? Is it really rigorous, or is it a quicker training process? Do you think that plays a role in their ability to, you know, maintain a rewarded feeling, even though they're maybe not getting paid as much as they should?
Well, the training process is necessary. I guess I never thought about it and how that might affect their kind of like feeling of satisfaction. But I would say that it takes, so the state mandates a 40-hour training for direct service providers, and different agencies provide that training along different timelines. But on average, I would say it's about 4 to 6 weeks before any individual service provider can really be responsible for individuals in terms of being able to understand all the laws, policies, and procedures. And depending on how many individuals they work with, you know, if you're in a group home where there's 4 individuals, that's 4 people who you need to know all the ins and outs of their medications and personal care. In a day program, you might be working with 40 different individuals. So it can be kind of that learning process can be more complicated. I would say in either setting, though, it's probably at least 3 months before you feel really competent at doing those things. So you kind of definitely have a long learning period where you're shadowing, having to ask questions, having to get support. So I'm sure that can be frustrating, especially if that person who's providing that training is probably getting pulled in a lot of different directions because they're having to help fill in the gaps for that staffing shortage during that period. There's not enough money in the budgets to be able to overstaff, to be able to plan for having, you know, a really comfortable work environment while you're still filling positions, considering that you're always filling positions. I think in the 6 years that I was there, I mean, there's maybe a matter of weeks where we were fully staffed and fully trained.
And I guess I hadn't thought about, as a part of the training process, you really have to get to know the individuals that you're caring for, especially if, say, in Brittany's case, where it'd be a smaller group of people, you're going to be working with them extensively. You want to know their routines. So, David, back to you. Have you heard of any ways that the agency or the home is trying to bring in workers? Are they out recruiting, or?
Yeah, absolutely. In our case, we work with them closely to kind of keep up on this, and they let us know when there's job fairs. They've done job fairs. They advertise on their website. I've seen signs outside their building over here on Bradley Avenue trying to hire people. So I trust that they're doing everything they can. Personally, I think it's just a matter of the wage. If people need to decide, do they want to take a $9 job here where it's going to be a tough job, or take a $9 job over at Burger King, where at the end of the day, they don't have to worry about it. They're probably going to choose the easier of the jobs.
So in the recruitment process, is Brittany involved at all in getting to know these people, or they hired first and then they get to know her?
Well, in her case, she doesn't have that level of comprehension, so she wouldn't be able to participate. But even if she did, I think that the staffing is probably done outside of her and the family.
Okay. And so, Sarah, would the training process then be that people are hired, trained, and then meet with the individuals that they'd be caring for?
It's a combination of kind of a classroom training experience and on-the-job training experience, because you can't really learn the nuances without, I mean, this is a kind of work that's built on relationship with other people. So you are you're getting, as much as you're getting trained on like kind of technical aspects of how to lift someone, you're also going, part of the training is helping to have people who you're responsible for your care feel comfortable and trust you, and you to feel comfortable and trust them. So that all has to happen kind of in a hands-on way.
Okay. And so how quickly, David, would you say that the agency has told you Brittany could move in if they were able to staff?
Well, this particular agency has they have shortages at all their houses. So at this point, they need to get all the other houses fully staffed before they'll even look at opening up Mahomet. So we'll know it's coming when they tell us that the other houses are staffed. But so I think it's a ways off.
Have you and your wife considered looking into other options, or would you rather wait for this particular home?
We have been looking at other options. In fact, there was another house that had a spot available, and we could have pursued that. But at this point, we're comfortable waiting because we know that the house we've chosen is the best fit for her.
And you said that the other individuals who she would be living with are people around her age. Are you in contact with their families and if they're willing to wait as well? Or
yeah, we are. We've met with them. The residents, they've met each other. We've gone out to eat just to kind of bond because we know we're going to be spending a lot of time with each other's kids.
Well, thank you so much to both David and Sarah for joining us for this conversation today on the 21st. We do have to take a short break here, but again, many thanks to you both. We'll continue our conversation on group homes and caregivers, the shortage, and the situation here in Illinois with a Chicago Tribune reporter coming up next on the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about some challenges that come with not having enough caregivers for people with disabilities, especially at group homes, which are becoming more and more common here in Illinois. I've been speaking with David Happ, who's here in the studio with me today. His daughter has autism and was approved to move into a group home, but there hasn't been enough staff for it. Sarah Curtis previously worked as a day program manager for the developmental services here in Champaign, but I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Michael Behrens is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. They found 200 cases of abuse and neglect at group homes in Illinois. Michael, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for joining our conversation today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So the Tribune found 1,311 cases of documented harm since July of 2011, hundreds more than what was reported from the Illinois Department of Human Services. So how did you find these cases, Michael?
Well, you know, finding them was difficult, and I think, you know, to start at the beginning, I think helps a little bit in the sense of, you know, what drew our attention to this, and I think this is also what's emblematic of the problem. I was reading a state report that said there were thousands, you know, nearly 3,000 state-licensed group homes in the state of Illinois. So when I called up the Department of Human Services and said, that's an amazing number, where are they? They said, we're not allowed to tell you, it's secret, it's confidential, you're not allowed to know where these homes are at. And then I asked, well, how many deaths have occurred inside these homes that have been attributed to negligence or abuse or harm? And they could not tell me which homes had the highest levels of abuse or neglect. Given that, we were on our own, and so we began, you know, sort of a massive public records request, which took, you know, many, many months, where we pulled every investigative file that the state had conducted in group homes. They redacted the addresses out of those investigative reports so we would not know where they occurred. But by using a variety of other records and talking to, you know, just dozens and eventually hundreds of people, we were able to piece together this tapestry of what was happening inside the state group home system. And I think, you know, secrecy does not serve it well. And I think when you peel back, you know, the covers, so to speak, you find that there is a lot of problems going on in a group home industry that's touted as the solution, you know, to the issue of what do we do and where do we help people who need long-term care.
So if I'm to understand, some of the horrible things that you're referencing here include people being mocked for intellectual limitations, barricaded in their rooms, and abandoned in soiled clothing. So in your research, can you give us some sense of what leads to this type of abuse?
Poorly trained employees, essentially. People who are placed in situations that they should never have been placed into. And I think when you talk to the directors and the owners of many of these nonprofit groups, which are trying to do, you know, a noble job here, what they will tell you is we are hiring people today that we would have never hired 3 years ago. And I think, you know, David hit it on the head when he talked about people would rather take a job at Burger King, perhaps, than a very challenging job, which requires a lot of training. And that's what a lot of these agencies are experiencing, is they cannot attract employees at $9 an hour. And it's arguable where they'll be able to attract them at $12 or even $15 an hour. It's a hard job. It requires specialized training. It requires compassion that's often unique. It's the kind of people that go into nursing, perhaps, or any medical field. So when you try to attract this level of employee with such a low salary, it creates problems. So in most of the cases that you're referencing, these were young 20-something employees. Some of them had only been on the job for weeks, some for months. And they are working with people with extraordinary challenges, you know, whether it's behavioral or medical or both. And they're just not equipped to deal with someone who, say, an autistic person who has, you know, very specific experiences or behavioral issues, and they don't know how to react to that, and sometimes then they react badly.
So, Michael, could you speak to this idea of the wages and why they're so low and why they're not prioritized as a job that can be both rewarding and paid an honest, livable,
sure,
manageable wage?
Well, you know, I think the bigger issue and the more important issue, perhaps, isn't, you know, what is the wage for the caregivers, although that's important. But the issue that's really driving this is, at what level will the state of Illinois pay group homes to provide care? Let's keep in mind that, you know, Illinois, as most states, have a horrible history of institutionalization or warehousing people in big box facilities such as nursing homes even. You know, decades ago, David's daughter, her, the only choice for her would be an institutional setting. You know, so through lawsuits and class actions, Illinois has adopted, you know, what is probably, you know, an incredibly noble idea. People will do better if they're in their communities, and let's move people out of the institutional settings when appropriate and put them into a community setting where they will undoubtedly thrive and have a better life. The problem is that Illinois doesn't want to pay what it takes to provide the care at a community level. And this is really the heart of the problem. The developmental agencies that we've talked to, the nonprofits, say it's not that we don't want to pay people more. There is no money to pay more. And it's because the state, again, wants to provide less money to community care than they were willing to pay for institutional care. In some cases, you know, it's a 3-to-1 ratio. It may, the number we've used in our previous stories is that an institutionalized resident may cost about $219,000 a year, where a group home resident can cost as low as $50,000 a year. And so it's a huge saving for the state, which, you know, subsidizes these expenses through Medicaid. But what a lot of group homes will tell you is the people that the state are trying to send into the community level need a high degree of care. As David said with his daughter, you don't leave her alone. You know, someone has to be with her. So if you have a house with four people like David's daughter, you're probably going to need at least a staff of four people inside that home. But what the organizations are telling us is the state is not providing enough money to put four people into those homes. And so they put one person sometimes into those homes, and that's when you have disastrous results.
Yeah. In your article, you mentioned that frontline caregivers failed to promptly call 911, perform CPR, or respond to medical emergencies in a timely fashion that sometimes resulted in death, and that can go back to the training. But let's focus on what agencies can do to fix this problem, in your opinion. Like, what are next steps outside of, you know, getting access to more funding and more money? Is there anything else that you see on the horizon that they could do?
Well, there's currently a class action suit. It involves a Ligas class action, and there's a court monitor who is filing reports with the court as we speak that the state of Illinois has inadequately funded the group home system. And so there are some legal avenues that are being pursued by the industry. I think it also, the other battle is legislative, and it's been unsuccessful at this point, of getting the state of Illinois to increase its funding formula. So the crux of the battle is Illinois says that they are adequately funding group homes. The group home industry is saying, no, you're not. We need much more money to be able to provide the level of care that's adequate for the people that you want us to serve. And so we've got a tug of war going on right now. It's the people, you know, the patients, the people who need the care who are the victims.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us. You've brought a lot of great information to the conversation. I also want to thank David and Sarah for joining us in our conversation today on the 21st. Sadly, that is all the time we have today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And an update on the case that Michael was just describing. On Friday, a federal court heard arguments from attorneys representing Illinois residents with developmental disabilities who stated the existence of group homes is, quote, precarious under current funding levels. And the newly approved state budget provides a 75-cent an hour wage increase, which lawyers say is simply not enough. Whether or not you're used to your body being a topic of conversation, you can expect it to be once you're pregnant. And for some, it can be extremely embarrassing and oftentimes uncomfortable. So writes Lauren Cheval, editor for Red Eye Chicago, in a recent column for the Chicago Tribune. She joins us now on the line to talk about her experiences with this. Lauren, welcome to the 21st, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, everyone is welcome to join the conversation. So have you received unwelcome comments about your body while pregnant? Give us a call right now, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21STShow. So, Lauren, you're 38 weeks pregnant now. And in your writing, you talk about how since entering your third trimester of pregnancy, you always have to wear headphones anytime that you're walking around. So why is that?
So I just kind of realized the first time that I forgot them, that if I don't, people on the street that I don't know feel free to just say, oh, like, you know, nice belly, sweetie, or, you know, that kind of stuff. Sometimes it seems sweet. Sometimes it seems a little creepy. But either way, it's just, if I don't have headphones in, they might catch my eye and kind of just feel free to make a comment as I'm walking by.
So these are just complete strangers that are coming up to you as you're going about your day, correct?
Yes.
And it's not just about complete strangers, though, either. I noticed in your column you were talking how unwelcome, awkward comments can also come from friends, family, people that we know and interact with on a more regular basis. So what kinds of things have you heard from those people?
It's kind of a tougher area because they obviously, you know, they're trying to be supportive. They're trying to be sweet. And it's just awkward on my end because I'm not used to talking about my body so much, but it's pretty much when you're pregnant, that's like all you're talking about. So people say like, oh, wow, you're getting so big, or they even say like in the beginning, I remember I'd feel kind of self-conscious because people would be like, oh, like, when are you going to start showing? Like, I thought you'd be showing by now. And then you kind of automatically go to, am I doing something wrong? Like, am I not, you know, like, is the baby not growing fast enough? Or am I not, you know, eating enough? Or so I think that people just, they don't mean anything by it. They're just kind of like trying to engage you in conversation, but it makes you kind of second guess your choices or what you're doing or how your body's reacting to this thing that is kind of outside of your control.
Right. They're putting it back on you. Like, well, why aren't you doing this? Or why is this happening to you in a situation that maybe your physical appearance really has nothing to do with how healthy you might be? But how do you typically respond to these comments?
So I typically respond just, very good naturedly. I kind of, to people that I know very good naturedly. People, strangers, I tend to just keep ignoring, which is more just kind of like my personality and how I handle those kind of things anyway. But I think that it's something that I've been processing throughout the pregnancy. And so as I've been writing these columns, it's something that I get a better feel for how I actually feel about it. And then I maybe been in a better position to talk to people when I'm like, oh, you know, I don't really feel comfortable. But from the beginning, I knew, like, you always hear about women who they get touched by strangers, like their belly or whatever. And that was something that I knew from the beginning. I don't want to be touched unless someone asks me. So even people who are, you know, my sister-in-law, my friends, people always ask me, like, oh, can I touch or can I feel if the baby's kicking? Because they knew up front that I wouldn't be comfortable with people just like putting their hands on my body.
So, Lauren, have you experienced strangers attempting to touch your belly or your body in any way, or just comments?
No, just comments. No one, thank God, no stranger has ever come to me and tried to touch me.
I know that we've all heard those stories, of course, of, you know, someone coming up to you perhaps in a grocery store and touching the belly without asking for permission. That is certainly something I couldn't wrap my head around doing, especially, you know, in a stranger interaction. But what kinds of feedback have you received from your column since writing it?
So a lot of the people that I know were very supportive, and even, you know, like a male coworker reached out to me and said, I really enjoyed your column. It taught me a lot, or I learned a lot from it, which kind of tells me that people aren't really thinking about how they're speaking to pregnant women or how they're talking about, you know, these like women's bodies. And so it's not something that's done out of, you know, a bad intent. It's just people aren't thinking. And so that was really gratifying for me. On the other hand, you know, just random people tweeting or commenting, I think that I'm too sensitive, or, oh, well, you should be grateful that people are saying nice things about your body. Like, heaven forbid they be saying something mean, you know, like, why are you so sensitive about this? So it's been a little mixed. It's been kind of both sides.
So I, you know, just want to point out your body is doing something amazing right now, right? It's growing this other human being inside of it, which is super powerful. So I'm curious what changes you have gone through personally throughout the course of your pregnancy in terms of the ways that you view your body or feel about your own body.
Oh, that's such a good question. So as I say in my column, my body has been the same for the last 10 years. I know that it's not everyone's experience, but my body really doesn't change very often. I'm just pretty consistent in my habits. So I haven't really had to go through any sort of major body changes before now. And so I think it's been very strange. And the biggest thing that I've had to deal with is kind of this loss of capability. And even in the first trimester when I wasn't showing, I was incredibly exhausted. Like I slept, I think, 16 hours a day sometimes. It just felt like I was always sleeping if I wasn't at work. And that was just really hard for me even then, because it felt like I wasn't capable. I wasn't able to do all the things that I was used to doing, whether it was, you know, giving 100% to my job or running errands the way I wanted to, or, you know, like doing things that just felt very normal that I was used to doing. And as I've gotten bigger, I'm not suffering from the same sort of chronic exhaustion, but just the things that I'm used to doing. You know, it's summertime, so usually I'd be playing tennis with my family or that kind of stuff. So just not being able to do the things that I'm so used to doing has been a weird adjustment for my brain, because I know that what I'm doing is so important, but it just also feels like part of me is missing. And I know that that's a huge part of pregnancy, is that you're preparing for this next phase of your life when you're not going to be able to do all the things that you used to do because you've made this decision to be a parent.
So perhaps just relinquishing a little bit of control there and getting used to that.
Yes, very much so.
Lauren Cheval is an editor for Red Eye. She recently wrote a column for the Chicago Tribune titled "Pregnancy Took My Body Away From Me and Gave It to Everyone Else." We'll tweet out a link to that article if you follow us at 21STShow on Twitter. And Lauren, thank you so much for being with us here on the 21st today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great.
We'll be right back.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. It's only been 11 days since the General Assembly overrode Governor Rauner's veto and passed a budget. But even though the longest budget impasse since the Great Depression is finally over, there's still plenty of political news to talk about and things to be done. The budget deal includes a provision that would prevent schools from getting funding unless the state government passes an evidence-based funding model. School superintendents, teachers, and students are waiting to see how their funding could be affected by what happens in Springfield over these next few weeks. All of this as Governor Rauner's office is seeing some major shakeups, with many of his senior staff stepping down as he gets ready for one of the most expensive statewide elections in history. As we like to do every Monday, we're joined by two political reporters to help us understand all of this. Mike Fouché is the publisher of The Daily Line. Ray Hodge is also from The Daily Line as their Springfield editor. They also just launched their Springfield newsletter today. Mike, Ray, welcome to The 21st, and thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here.
Thanks, Liz.
So, Ray, starting with you, in the days after the budget was passed, we heard reactions from people all over the state, right? Many people at social service agencies and public schools felt some measure of relief instantly, but then also were saying that the consequences of not having a budget for so long will be felt for much more time to come. And we've also heard from some Republicans and members of the business community that while it's good to have a budget, there's some frustration that none of the economic policies they wanted were ever taken up by the General Assembly. And I mention all of this because I'm curious, what's the State House been like these last, it's been like a week and a half since the budget passed?
Well, as right now, since the passage of the budget was such an enormous amount of legislative activity, you have a lot of public officials who are currently out of office. So we're going through a small, intense period of quiet. A lot of the time right now is being spent prepped for the examination and taking up of Senate Bill 1, the Evidence-Based Funding for Student Success Act. Now, what that would do is actually directly impact the funding that we're seeing out of SB 6, which was recently passed. The budget itself passed $7.67 billion, or at least authorized that amount, for K through 12 education for the coming fiscal year. And SB 1, which is about to be what we're going to see coming up very shortly, as we've had confirmation from Senate President Cullerton, that would actually authorize it. And it includes a new funding model, in fact. That new funding model would account for about $565 million in primary and second education spending, but as a result, it would sort of tweak the formulas that we've seen so far.
Okay, so staying on Senate Bill 1, or commonly known as SB 1, you kind of talked a little bit about the politics there, but we spoke about this with Superintendent Jennifer Garrison of Sandoval Community Unit 501 recently. In fact, just a day after the budget passed, that first week of July, and this is in the area of Illinois, which is about an hour east of St. Louis, and this is what she had to say.
We do have a bill, Senate Bill 1, that passed both chambers May 31st and is awaiting the governor's signature. So we're hoping that the governor will sign Senate Bill 1 so we have our new evidence-based model ready to go for when payments should be distributed the beginning of August. The Illinois State Board of Education, we've been told, needs to have the funding formula in place by August 2nd because we usually get our first state payment, general state aid, on around August 10th.
And Ray, August is right around the corner. So what's that status as far as Senate Bill 1 is going? Like, do you expect that this can happen in time for schools to get the funding they need for the fall?
I think the pressure is definitely on, Liz. We've got a situation here where we've got some definite bipartisan sort of measures that have occurred in the legislature, but once again, we're coming head-to-head with the same sort of familiar battle between the executive and legislative branches. Now, the governor is out doing education speaking reform panels today, so we'll kind of see as the day rolls on what some of the results are coming in from his speaking panels and his appointments today. We kind of looking to see what the buzz is around that to sort of indicate where his position might be on it. But the pressure is certainly on. August 10th is that deadline. Previously, we've heard quotes from him saying that, yes, schools will open. So what it's going to take to get there is just yet to be seen.
So, Ray, I want to stick with you on this topic for just a couple more minutes, or just at least a minute more. For listeners who might not be following this as closely, can you remind us exactly what an evidence-based funding model looks like?
So basically what we've had so far in terms of how we fund schools, right, we've got a particular sort of formula that allows us to allocate funding to schools based on a couple of different things. And the two factors that really primarily go into it are the estimated property values in a particular school district, so how much property value you've really got that can give students resources. That combines with your average daily attendance. So when those two things sort of combine, you've got a funding formula that allows you to allocate based on that. Now, the performance, the sort of target performance language that's in the new bill in SB 1, this would actually recalculate things. It would take into the account for the cost. It would be quality education as it's based on 27 different elements, right? And those things include things like the number of teachers, aides, nurses, and libraries that each school district needs in order to educate its students at a particular level.
Okay, and so can you give me just a quick synopsis of who's against this and why they're against it?
Some of the proponents that we've seen speaking against it in particular are a handful on the Republican side. In particular, you've got proponents of a different bill altogether, SB 1124, which is sort of a competing measure. It would seek to eliminate the Chicago Public School System's sort of block grant in a way. It would also sort of push back against some of the funding which is allocated in our budget bill. Basically, the main pushback is they want to see those who are against this bill want to see fewer dollars being spent towards resolving Chicago public school system's mounting pension issues in order to redistribute those dollars to districts which have lower income students in them.
So, Mike, I want to switch gears here just for a moment to the other big news item in these past few days, and that's the major shakeup in Governor Rauner's senior staff. Many people have been fired or resigned, including his chief of staff, deputy chief of staff, and campaign spokesperson. And just this morning, we also learned that his policy chief, Mike Mahoney, is going to be stepping down as well. So can you give us a sense of why this is happening and why now?
Well, why it's happening is because Governor Bruce Rauner has decided that he wants to go in a new direction, as is his right. He's the governor. He should be able to pick a staff that will carry out his views. And a lot of the people that are resigning are being replaced by people that are brought in from the Illinois Policy Institute, which is a right-thinking or right-wing conservative-thinking organization that has really criticized a lot of the policies that his existing staff has made. Curiously enough, though, a lot of the funding for the Illinois Policy Institute has come directly from Bruce Rauner's wallet. So he has been funding an organization that has criticized a lot of his staff already. So I suppose he's just cutting out the middleman and bringing in the people that he's been funding on the outside over to the inside.
That's very interesting. I did not know that. Yeah.
The timing is auspicious. You know, he just had somewhat of a defeat by having his veto overridden on the budget. Now I guess he's decided that he wants to go in a new direction.
And Mike, speaking to that point in particular that you just made, Governor Rauner is insisting that this staff shakeup has nothing to do with the budget deal, which is what we were referencing there with this potential defeat, as some are calling it. So, and that includes the 10 House Republicans that helped Democrats override his veto. Are you buying that claim from him that this has nothing to do with the budget?
You know, it doesn't really matter what it is that I think. You know, he does what he does. It's his choices. He's going to be making the policies and running government as he sees fit. He's the governor. Whether or not it's related to budget, who knows? I think, though, that there's definitely a message that's being sent to a lot of other Republicans in Illinois, which is that he has a very specific direction that he's going to be going in, and he has a very specific set of policies. And as a lot of Republicans refer to him, Uncle Bruce, you know, he has been writing a lot of checks to keep the Republican organization in the state above water, and more than above water, flush. So I think the message that he's sending to a lot of Republicans in Illinois is, I'm going to be getting more conservative. I'm going to be going further to the right. If you want to continue to receive my largesse, you better move with me.
So looking towards the future, one particular senior staff member who resigned on Friday, Mike Zonielerwitz, who was the governor's first chief of staff and then not only helped Governor Rauner win in 2014, but also helped Republicans win six seats in the state house since. Looking towards the future, I believe Rauner is planning on a big reelection campaign, potentially one of the most expensive, at least in the Midwest. So how significant is it that this gentleman is no longer going to be in the picture?
I think it's a big deal, but, you know, I caution against kind of gaming the system and saying, well, you know, one person's change is going to move everything. There's still a lot of time, and there are plenty of people in Illinois and across the country that whose thinking aligns with the Illinois Policy Institute that would like to help carry out a campaign according to those ideals. You know, Rauner will have no trouble finding talented people, particularly since he has a big, giant wallet in order to write checks. And, you know, there was a lot of poo-pooing of Trump's agenda when he was running for president. I don't see why we can't give Rauner a good, you know, plenty of room to see what it is that he's going to be able to do. Since Trump was successful, you know, maybe Rauner will be able to do the same.
So sticking to that policy side of things, do you think there's room for much cooperation between Governor Rauner and state House lawmakers in this next year and a half that we have to go?
Well, he's definitely made it harder. There's no question about it. You know, he has said that, you know, he was defeated on a budget by a veto override, and there were a number of sitting Republican lawmakers who went over to the left, went to the center, and Rauner's response is, I'm going to go further right. Now, that might be great in terms of winning an election, we have to see, but it's certainly making it more difficult in terms of governing when the legislature has already said, we want to go more centrist, and Rauner has said, no, I'm going to go more right. He is certainly responding towards a loss by saying that he's going to be less willing to negotiate.
So, Ray, going back to you, so based on these staff shakeups and everything that we're talking about here with Rauner and lawmakers, is there anything that we can learn from these past 2 days about what's the next year and a half is going to look like, in your opinion?
Well, what we have to focus on is whether or not this enormously large SB1 is going to pass, really. That's going to be the turnkey that determines quite a bit about the working relationship between the legislature and Governor Rauner. Going ahead into the campaign, that may additionally have dramatic impact because, you know, at the end of the day, if schools are shorted or if school districts feel shorted or if there's any issues getting them open with the amount of debt that they are looking at, then that's going to dramatically impact not only the entire sort of legislative process, but that's going to impact races everywhere. That could cause a kind of, you know, political shakeup that would, you know, really endanger quite a few campaigns here. And I mean, that may seem obvious, but it really can't be emphasized enough how important going forward this education bill really is. It's quite at the heart of what the legislature has on its plate.
Well, certainly. I mean, there's no lawmaker out there that can say they don't have a school district or at least some sort of educational, you know, impact to their constituents with the SB1 situation on the table. But sadly, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Mike Fouché and Ray Hodge of the Daily Line for joining us today to talk about state politics on the 21st. You can always find past shows on the NPR. Just search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play the 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and other ways you can connect and contact us via phone, email, social media, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter, search for 21stshow. We'll live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And on our Facebook page, you can search for the 21st to like us, and then you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments if you'd like us to ask those on the air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.